Hi, I'm Mark Chavez. I'm one of the hosts of Let's Make a comedy docuseries podcast about the creative process. Each season, my co-hosts, Ryan Beal, Maddie Kelly, and I take on an artistic challenge and you follow our journey. In Let's Make a Sci-Fi, we wrote a science fiction TV pilot. In Let's Make a Rom-Com, we wrote a romantic comedy film. And on our latest season, Let's Make a Horror, we produced a horror short film. And when we run into trouble, we interview Hollywood experts. People who have worked on big things like The Blair Witch Project, The Office, Star Wars, Mamma Mia, and more. All three seasons of Let's Make a are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, welcome to Q. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. I don't know if you've noticed this trend in Hollywood, maybe over the last few years, maybe even decade, that a movie has got to have a message behind it, that when you take home your leftover popcorn afterwards, you got to take home a lesson as well, think about something. When Zelda Williams sat down to make her debut feature film, she kind of wanted to do the opposite of that trend. She wanted to make a movie that was campy and funny and okay, maybe has a lesson or two in it, but is most importantly fun for the cast and for you, the audience. Her directorial debut is called Lisa Frankenstein. It's a story that follows a teenage girl who falls in love with a Victorian corpse, as you do, while dealing with grief. It's set in the 80s. It's very reminiscent of classics like Beetlejuice and Heathers. And as you'll hear in a second, if all anyone takes from this movie is just a fun night out with their friends, Zelda Williams is happy. And this desire to make people laugh might not come as a surprise when you learn that Zelda is the daughter of Robin Williams, late great comedian and actor. Tom Power sat down to talk to Zelda about her relationship to comedy, about how she honors her dad, and what it was like making the movie Lisa Frankenstein. Here's their conversation.
Talk to me a little bit about how this movie came together. So the story I heard is really interesting. So Diablo Cody writes the script. We had Diablo on, I think, maybe about a month ago. And for people who don't know, Diablo is, we had her on for the Jagged Little Pill musical. And for people who don't know, she won an Academy Award for her first ever screenplay for Juno. And when you get the script, you don't know that it's Diablo. You just think it's just someone looking for help with their script or something?
It's a little convoluted, but essentially someone we have in common who I had helped out years before and kind of, we would check in on each other periodically. The pandemic happened. And so those check-ins happened for a lot of people just being like, are you okay? Yeah. And he proceeded to say, hey, you know, my girlfriend wrote this script. She thinks it's too weird. Or something. He was like, she doesn't know who it would be right for. And I think you're the right person for it. Can I send it to you? Completely buried the lead. Didn't say his girlfriend was Diablo. And so I get this email that then proceeds to have her script in it. And I'm like, wow, okay. Immediately read it and really fell in love with the idea of making something quite patently 80s, which doesn't really come along very often. Certainly never did when I was an actor. So kind of embarked on it from there. He connected us. And I really like that it didn't come through that kind of Suits universe that can be LA. It came through actual friend connections.
I can only imagine, though, that like, okay, I'm going to get this script from somebody. Hey, my friend's girlfriend or like someone I know's girlfriend. And then you're getting sort of, again, like someone who is sort of preternaturally gifted scriptwriter in your inbox.
What was the question? Sorry.
There's no questions, Zelda. There's no question. There's no questions, Zelda. No, there's no questions here. There's no questions. The way the show works is that I ask a question, you answer, and then I just say something afterwards.
Okay.
That's the way. Enough. That's the way. I don't know. Yeah. You haven't spent much time in Canada. That's kind of how it works up here.
I also really haven't spent much time doing any of this. It's all been very new for me. Even as an actor, I never really did much in the way of interviews. So now as a director, having to navigate them is particularly odd.
Well, you're killing it. You're nailing it. And you're the Diablo Cody of doing interviews. What was interesting to you about making an 80s movie? You were born in like the late 80s.
I was actually born in the year this film was supposed to take place. So obviously wasn't very aware of the time period at the moment of that. But in making it, a lot of the movies that I love very much were made around this period. And I think that, you know, particularly where we're at now in terms of cinema, I like that it feels so distinctly different. The editing was different. Tone, the exploration of tone that they were doing at the time was very different. And so I think wanting to get to experience that and also have a bunch of young actors experience that was really exciting for me.
Well, why is that exciting to you? Like, what is the tone you saw in these 80s movies that that doesn't exist now that you feel like maybe needs to come back?
Well, first and foremost, camp. You know, everything got quite serious. And if it wasn't serious, even in a comedy sphere, it got quite sarcastic or self-referential. And I think there is an earnestness oftentimes to camp. There is sort of an earnest silliness, weirdness, oddity. And not taking oneself seriously, I think, is a very important part of this industry as well. I think it needs that pairing opposite the things that are very morally challenging or interesting philosophically. I'm like, you also need just pure escapist silliness and weirdness.
Do you like this song? Do you like any other music? I have the cure.
Ooh.
Oh. No. It's not that kind of cure. It's like a... it's a band. They can't make you better. I mean, they can, but emotional.
I liked all of that. I missed all of that. I realized in what I was watching, I just didn't see much of it either. So... it was daunting, certainly. Comedy was the scariest thing for me to try and approach, but I was excited by the prospect.
Why was it so scary?
I mean, it's the thing I grew up understanding and seeing the toll it takes. It's, there's many ways that you can, I mean, they used to say skin a cat, but make a movie. there are a lot of things that are kind of seen as law and how you do stuff. Comedy has always been a bit more lawless, and there's very few guarantees that you're going to make people laugh. Certain things will pretty regularly make people cry or feel emotional. Laughter is a really hard dragon to chase. And I knew that very distinctly in growing up around it. So I think it was the one that I felt like I would get particularly... harshly judged for doing, and would also find the hardest to do, but I actually really loved doing it. So
is the other part of the answer, and again, only talk about this as much as you want, is the other part of that, that, hey, my last name is Williams, my dad's Robin Williams. Like the, you said like to make a comedy would be scary. Just given the expectation on you, is that what you meant?
I mean, yes and no. I think, at this point, it's not really my expectation of myself.
No.
But I do certainly think that there are people who would have ideas about what I'm supposed to make or how it's supposed to make them feel. And he made stuff that was so universally appealing. And this isn't that. So by nature of making something kind of niche and strange, I think... there was at least a little comfort in that, whether or not other people took it that way. I expected some people to really hate this movie, but I don't know if they expected me to make something that wasn't necessarily universal, if that makes sense, in a comedy sphere.
Yeah, the expectation that you would make something big and universal and broad and for a gigantic audience.
Sure, or even just like heartwarming, message-oriented in the way that a lot of them, you know, when they remember those movies, that's so much of what was the joy in them was this heart. And this is actually kind of almost like there is a love story in this and there is a lot of heart in it, but it's kind of like a, it's like a heart with arrhythmia. It's a little off.
but it's not like, the film's not bereft of things to make you think about. Like, I don't want people to think that you're watching this film and sort of only getting an oddball wild comedy. I mean, I read this quote from you getting ready for this interview, and it said, we spend so much time trying to make the way we navigate anything more palatable for others, especially women, Lisa gets to do the opposite in this. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that? Like that sort of bending over backwards to be acceptable and how Lisa in this film gets to do the opposite?
Sure. I mean, especially these days, and I think by nature of social media, a lot of people spend so much of their energy curating the way they go through things to have an audience respond to them. This is kind of the opposite of that. I think Lisa, in an interesting way, was used to not being liked and then found one person who loved her, then realized someone else loved her too, and that was enough. So if everyone else hated her, she was kind of fine with it. But ultimately as well, I do think the movie, I think we've entered a phase where people act as if it's a negative to say it's completely all right to enjoy a movie and not take a message from it as well. I actually am fine with that. If this just brought some people who wanted joy, joy, who am I to say, oh, but you didn't take this other thing too?
No, I know what you mean. There can be a tendency to look only for the message behind a film or the subtext behind a film or the thing that I sort of find challenging in this job sometimes is not to like go towards the autobiographical in a film. It's like not to ask people, you know, hey, so you wrote this film about, you know, blah, 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 you know, your time opening a bakery. Hey, your uncle owned a butcher shop, which is kind of like a bakery, you know, like I find it hard not to, I feel like I'm feeling a lot of stress to add a question onto the end of this, by the way, but like, I feel like I understand what you're talking about there.
Well, and it's interesting too, because obviously I didn't write this one. So it's interesting to watch people draw parallels between a script that I did not change, that I just received to my life sometimes. Because I'm like, oh no, it's not mine.
Oh, people are making parallels between Lisa losing her mom and you losing your dad.
Yeah,
because that's such an easy parallel. That's obviously a very clear parallel to make. But you know, your job is just to take Diablo's script and put it on screen.
Yeah, which has been interesting. I expect it, but it's also been very funny to be like, how do I very gently say nope?
Well, there is I like the rainbow suspenders. The Mork and Mindy suspenders were in the film. I thought that was lovely. You know.
There were little Easter eggs all over it from all of us. Everyone kind of got a little bit of their input. And the rainbow suspenders were just by nature of like, yes, this isn't our universe, because it's already, we're established in the beginning. It's a universe where death isn't permanent. But I kind of liked the idea of, if that universe exists in this movie, then maybe dad exists in that universe too. So the rainbow suspenders not being his, you know, actual ones, but just being an homage to that style at the time was kind of nice for me. It was nice to tie that together. But, you know, at the same time, you're like, also, we're just a bunch of nerds hanging out in New Orleans. Those suspenders are actually my suspenders. I usually wear them on my work overalls. Because I like that they're kind of this joyful thing that always makes people smile. But I figured I'd put him on Cole because he was wearing these really lovely high-waisted pants and just kind of take it full circle.
How did you end up getting interested in directing in the first place? I mean, I know you're starting to get into writing, but you started out as an actor, right?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, especially when you're a teenager, and we can unpack how much this might be the last industry that justifies child labor. But as a teenager, there's not really other options for you to come into this industry, right? If you want to work in this industry right off the bat, you're probably going to be an actor. They're not going to hand a film to a 16-year-old.
No, but you wanted to work in the industry. Like, you were interested in the industry even then.
Yeah, no, very much so. And I was writing even then. But I think, you know, I'm very grateful for the fact I learned the ropes of this industry via acting and voice acting. But there's a part of me that almost would have been curious to see if I had waited, if I had done the more kind of collegiate route and come in as a director sooner, what that would have looked like. Because this industry's not a kind place to anyone, but particularly to young women. I think your sense of self gets extremely warped via the things that are told to you, usually just as criticism of like you not being right for a part.
I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You're listening to Q, more of Tom's conversation with Zelda Williams coming up.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
You're in the middle of Tom Power's conversation with Zelda Williams. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom here on Q. Zelda is a writer, actor, and director. And her new movie, her first movie, is called Lisa Frankenstein. It's available on video on demand now. Zelda is also the daughter of Robin Williams, the late actor and comedian who died in 2014. Zelda and Tom have been talking about how her sense of self was affected by getting into acting when she was young and just sort of participating in the Hollywood system in general. Zelda knows that from her own experience and also because of what she watched her dad go through. Robin Williams was the kind of actor and comedian that resonated with people so deeply. And when you hit that kind of iconic status, you almost become a mythical character to other people. So Tom wanted to know what Zelda's experience of that was like. And that's where their conversation picks up.
I got to talk to Ziggy Marley one time. And I said, your dad was this, you know, his dad was Bob Marley. And I said, your dad to me. His dad, Anthony Hopkins, actually. his dad, I said, your dad to me is a t-shirt and a flag and and a box set and a bad college cover band. Your dad to other people is the symbol of the nation of Jamaica. Is this ever weird for you? Because he's your dad and you miss him. And he was just a guy who you miss. As much as you want to talk about this, Zelda, how does it work for you when people have this sort of idea and apotheosis of your dad? I mean, he means his work and his like life meant so much to so many people. How does that intersect with your own love for him and life with him and maybe your own grief for him?
I mean, to be honest, the only thing it's really affected in terms of a interacting with other people thing is dating. I'm very good at curating my own grief at this point. I used to share it a lot more and now I don't feel the need to. And both of those stages in it, I respect for myself. So that part is fine and feels very healthy at this point for me. But dating is really hard. I didn't realize until I got to now, again, like a grown woman age, how much he affected what would be considered my dateable age range. And I date women and men, but men in particular were quite raised by him in a way, whether they aspired to be like him or they just were like, this is the dad I wish I had, or I've heard many options. And I don't know what it is, but unless they can remove their remembrance of that, they'll start seeing me do things that are like him. One of them broke up with me because I laugh like him and he couldn't unhear it. And then it like desexualized me. And I was like, that sounds like a you problem, but also like, bye. That's really fucking weird, guys. Sorry.
You weren't like, oh, no, come on back. I'll change.
I mean, at that point, you're like, I can't help you.
Yeah, I know.
Freud would have a field day. I wish you the best. But that's been only, I think, the only really interesting passage of the last 10 years for me. has been the realization that while I am incredibly at peace and enjoying my life alone, partnership is still very affected by someone who's been gone for almost 10 years now. Right. Which is wild to think that my now decades gone parent, who this person, whoever I wind up with, will likely have never met.
Yeah.
He could still affect them. I was like, why are you cock blocking me from beyond the grave? It's still, I find it very entertaining, but it is still very weird. That's probably the only part that I find strange. The rest of it is just a natural process. I navigate death quite a lot, but I think that's just
luck or
unlucky, whatever it is. I have lost a lot of people. And I think if nothing else, it's made me very appreciative and present. Nothing is guaranteed to any of us in terms of lifespan.
Yeah.
So I take, you know, that's my biggest takeaway is you don't get to know if you get tomorrow. So if
it does
you can.
Give you that, it does give you that really early, doesn't it? Sometimes I wonder whether that was a good thing to learn at such a young age that like, because I think most of the time, I think it was a good thing. Like I was telling you before we started the interview that I lost my dad when I was in my early 20s too. And I think for a long time I was like, this is good. Give me the gift of impermanence and the gift of looking at life all around me and realizing that I only get one of it. And then sometimes I wonder whether it would have been nice just to have the blinders on just a couple more decades. You know what I mean?
There's a Neil Gaiman kind of story who deals with death all the time by nature of the characters in his work. There's one called Death, the High Cost of Living. And without explaining the rest of the story, just that title alone is kind of the main thing we're talking about. It's funny to have also made a movie that kind of makes death into a punchline and also a funny, impermanent thing. Which I don't think is a bad thing. I think also finding brevity in it is important. There's the note at the end of the movie as well saying, death is temporary, I'll love you forever. And I think that's a very real thing. We don't get to actually resurrect the dead in our current universe, but that concept is, if anything, the very real aspect of a well-lived life, even if, as you said, like we wound up navigating mortality young, but I do think it helped us, from what you were explaining, find your way towards a love, whether it's another person or a love of the present or those kinds of things. I do think that's one of the bigger takeaways, if you can navigate and grieve in a way that becomes healthy.
Zelda, what a joy to talk to you, man. Thanks so much.
Lovely to talk to you too. Sorry for making you feel pressured to ask questions.
Still thinking about that beautiful quote, death is temporary, I'll love you forever. That's beautiful. That was Zelda Williams in conversation with Tom Power. Zelda's debut feature film is called Lisa Frankenstein. It's available on Peacock in the United States next week. But if you cannot wait until next week, that's okay. You can buy or rent it on video on demand now. Okay, that's it for this episode, but there is another interview in your podcast feed right now. It's Tom's conversation with award-winning Canadian filmmaker Clement Virgo, who directed Brother, spectacular film if you haven't seen it. And it has this incredibly honest depiction of grief that isn't cartoonish or cheesy. It's just really real. And you can hear Clement explain to Tom how he approached that, how he managed that with the story and with the actors. Really great conversation with an important Canadian filmmaker. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. I'll see you next time.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.